From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. My name is Arthur DeMolder.
And I'm Amanda Marino.
And we are currently master students specializing in urban resilience. This is the first episode from a series of Student Takeover, where students from the master's degree in City Resilience Design and Management at the Universidad Internacional de Catalunya will be taking over the co-host mantle from Corinna and Chiara, who initiated this podcast. In this episode of Urban Resilience Dialogues, we're talking about the topic of justice. When presented with the word justice, our minds tend to jump to the concept of legislation, the ethical, philosophical idea that people are to be treated impartially, fairly, and reasonably according to the law. When we examine how the concept of justice plays out in relation to resilience, and specifically urban resilience, it raises a number of questions. How do we negotiate the uneven distribution of risks and vulnerabilities? How do we intervene to adjust urban inequities and injustice? And how does this look like when we talk about the intensifying effects of climate change or more structural societal breakdown or conflict?
So, big questions, right? Well, we're excited to have just the right person to explore all of this with us. We're excited that for this episode, we're joined by Suchi Vora. Suchi is the Resilience Knowledge Coalition Lead at the Global Resilience Partnership. She drives practitioner-oriented shared learning on measurement and evidence for locally led adaptation and systems change through knowledge brokering, thought leadership, and narrative building.
So Suchi, we'd love to hear more about your life story, your academic career, and how you ended up working in the field of resilience.
Great question. And I always wonder how I answer this, and it differs every time, and I learn new things about myself every time I answer this question. So I started out as an engineer, chemical engineer, in fact, worked in a factory. And there were a couple of things that kept gnawing at me when I was working there. And one thing, obviously, was that I was among the first women on the shop floor at that point in India, in that particular factory, not overall in India. But of course, very few women work in factories even now, right? And I had to work doubly hard to gain the same kind of respect from my peers and the support staff and the operators and people who reported to me compared to the men in the team. That was one part. And the other part that kept gnawing at me was how the inequity that was entrenched in the system, this extremely hierarchical system, if you will, was constructed in a way that people who sold off land to build the factory were the very same people who were working at the lowest level. And the way those of us who came from cities, who were straight out of college, straight out of university, as young students, young professionals coming into work and actually working above them because there was a certain form of knowledge that was valued over the other. Questions of justice, yes. But from there on, I moved into social science, always exploring these questions as I studied urban policy and governance, what was then called Habitat Policy and Practice, this course, at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences. And there I pretty much started my development career with working with RAPSICOS on their water access issues in Bombay near the landfill, so around the landfill. And very stark contrast compared to what I was doing before, but also very enriching and lots of learning for life. But then I felt like there was a key piece that was missing in my skills, and that was environment and conservation. And so I moved to the Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF, where I worked on Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities in the Ganga River Basin, working on multi-stakeholder partnerships, working with people and connecting them to nature, but largely working on urban constituencies for water-sensitive cities. So that was my goal. Post which, once I handed over plan of the city and had like traction around it, handed it over to the municipal government at that point. I felt like I was ready to move on to the next step, move to University of Oxford, where I did a second master's on water science policy and management. I got a chance to explore the world. So I went to Kenya to figure out what were the drivers for river flows. So environmental flows is a big issue, which drives allocations to cities, agriculture, and the competition behind it. And I was curious to find out how these drivers can be played around with, if you will, but not so much gamified, but really tinkered with to identify how environmental flows can be ensured in the river. And from there on, I moved to the Nature Conservancy. I worked on drought resilience, both in urban and rural spaces, acting as an enabler of bottom-up plans for drought resilience in these spaces. And drought, while it tends to be a water subject, it's also an extremely complex subject. It's a social ecological phenomenon. It's not just climate change, but a wide variety of factors impacting it, which were super interesting until COVID struck and we all needed to be resilient, right? And that was the point when I realized I wanted to move into something that was in the space of knowledge brokering and shared learning. And that's when I got into GRP, where I've been working on shared learning, knowledge brokering, and stewarding this community of practice called the Resilience Evidence Coalition now, and working with young people on a wide variety of issues, strengthening their skills as resilience professionals.
Great, thanks, Suchi. As Arthur mentioned in the intro, justice in resilient cities is a complex and challenging topic. It encompasses a wide range of issues, including social justice, environmental justice, and economic justice. It also requires balancing the needs of different groups and individuals, especially when cities have been built on a foundation of systemic racism and discrimination. This has resulted in marginalized communities being disproportionately exposed to environmental hazards, living in substandard housing, and lacking access to quality food systems, education, and healthcare. And on top of this all, we have the issue of time. So considering how today's decisions might affect just outcomes for generations that aren't even born yet, how do we navigate these challenges and prioritize justice when fostering resilience in cities? And is there an example of a place or a city who you believe is doing this right? We know this is a hard one.
Excellent question. And this is pretty much at the edge of where we're thinking about justice, because it's a continuous challenge, a continuous process to get justice, right? There have been a wide variety of issues around which justice movements have come about, and people have tried and claimed rights, some successful, some not, but still. And it's pretty much at the edge of where and how we understand justice, this question. So thank you for asking, firstly. And in terms of what are those different ways in which we can navigate, or how do we navigate? There are a few different ways. There's no right or wrong. It's just probably what suits both the constituencies, the situations, and the self the most, especially since, you know, the self is, we as practitioners are equally a part of and actors within that system of creating justice, right? It's a constant, it's a process, it's a relational process that we're talking about here. And so there's advocacy, obviously, where rights-based approaches have been the focus of environmental and social justice movements, protests. We've seen all of that. We see all of that very, very living, breathing movements. We see those on TV and everywhere else. So advocacy, of all forms, so the protest being one, but also social media advocacy, and beyond that, all forms of advocacy, writing, policy briefs, research, etc. There's also allyship, And the fact that it's not just for the advocate to speak about and for those who are practitioners of advocacy to speak about certain issues around justice. So there's allyship and speaking up when needed. And so we all can be advocates for justice, right? And the third one, I think, is something that we've been mulling over at GRP, is the role of facilitation and the role of how experts can facilitate these processes, especially processes within urban systems, which can be really complex, which can be highly heterogeneous sets of communities, nature being a strong voice or sometimes not a voice. And so balancing these different voices, the vulnerable, the powerful or the power up, the power down, voices within a system and facilitating a process, which is just, is the third way in which this can be dealt with. Examples of places, of cities who've done well, I think there are a few of those who have implemented great public transport systems, for example, you know, Curitiba established, and a lot of my examples are from the Global South because there is a Global North and South dichotomy when we talk about justice. That's the first essential dichotomy within justice, right? So Curitiba being one, the bus rapid transit system was set up way back, I think 20 years back, which acted as a great alternative to expensive metros and became like a just equalizer within the city. Housing system in the favelas of Brazil has been touted as a great solution, slum upgradation, the way that slum and shack dwellers international has been working with slum dwellers and their plans around their slums being upgraded, their housing rights. These are all great examples of justice and of the way that cities have been reacting to this.
So a topic that you just touched upon that I would like to elaborate is this topic of awareness. Awareness regarding environmental justice has vastly increased over the past decade. We also have much better evidence that shows, for example, that high-risk areas are often populated by the poorest and most marginalized segments of the population. And of course, all of this is compounded by the age-old issue of money. We know that the gap in adaptation funding for developing countries is huge. I believe it was recently estimated to be 5 to 10 times lower than the required amount. Closing the funding gap on adaptation and resilience bears, of course, key implications for justice as to minimize suffering, loss of lives, livelihoods, and is key to equitable development outcomes amongst the most vulnerable. Consequently, the question we would like to ask is, how do you believe the following issues should be addressed? How do we square the lack of money with the increase in high-risk areas and segments of the population? Where do you see any approaches that are building on urban resilience with the limited resources available? Any innovative governments or any examples you would like to raise with regards to awareness?
Great one. I think another great question. As far as funding is concerned, it's critical not only to close the funding gap, but also to build trust within the funding cycles. So there are two aspects to it. We need to ensure that more money is flowing into the places that need that money, and which is an element of justice. And two, there is a crucial element where we ensure that this funding that is made available is not for shorter cycles. It's to ensure that we have patient funding available, building trust, allowing for failure, allowing for innovation. And that those are places where we've seen more success, really. Or we should see more success, for that matter. So how we can square this lack of money and this idea of risk areas and money is there are a few different ways that I can think of, and one of them is tapping the huge potential of the private sector. Definitely, the private sector is an actor in this space. They have not just their value chains, but also their customers, their consumers within the same cities where they, which are, you know, spaces of consumption and production for the private sector. So one, definitely getting the private sector involved. Two, and this one is the difficult one, is to recognize shifts in the way that that funding happens and shifting the way that funding happens to ensure that resources are earmarked for these high risk regions. So whenever you all become practitioners in intermediaries or systems which are lending or acting as grant makers to these regions, ensure that fewer resources are spent in the process and more resources land up at the actual community level. So that's, I think that's the other way. And where this has been working out, it's a difficult question. But a few different companies have been doing very well within the private sector. It's not a topic that I specialize in, so I'm not going to name or claim that a particular company or a particular organization does a good job, but there are definitely examples available. In terms of governance systems that have worked well, I think clear social audits, transparent mechanisms of money available, social audits and environmental audits have worked very well in Nepal and India and Bangladesh. The Right to Information Act has worked very well in terms of how the money has flown down to the lowest level in India. So these are examples of ways in which transparency can be involved so that people themselves become the agents of change and are able to ask that question of where is that money going.
Building on the topic of protecting the most vulnerable high-risk populations, locally led adaptation, LLA, is an approach to climate change adaptation that puts local communities in the lead. It recognizes that local communities are the most knowledgeable about their own needs and vulnerabilities, and that they are best placed to develop and implement adaptation solutions that work for them. Radical collaboration is essential for LLA to be successful. This means that all stakeholders, including local communities, government agencies, NGOs, and the private sector, need to work together to support LLA initiatives. Radical collaboration also requires a willingness to share power and resources and to learn from each other. How do we ensure that equity and justice are established in the LLA initiatives? How can we make this possible? How do we, for example, navigate conflicting views about what should be done, or what do we do when there's no agreement on consensus about what action to prioritize?
So to answer this question, I think we need to take a step back and think about what is LLA, right? What is locally led adaptation? And there are 8 principles that have very succinctly outlined that power needs to be devolved to those who are at the highest risk, who face the most risk and are impacted disproportionately by climate change. And when I say power, it's decision-making. So decisions around how they adapt, what are those solutions, but also the finance, the capital, being patient, in process, which I alluded to earlier, and the role of science as well. And countries and governments investing in science such that these decisions that these communities make are not based, not just based on their own knowledge or their own experience, but are also based very strongly rooted within science. So it's a combination of mainstreaming their indigenous knowledge, their lived experience, and giving equal weightage to science. So it's not one or the other. And that's a critical important aspect of the locally led initiatives, locally led adaptation initiatives. And ensuring that equity and justice are established here is about shifting of power, from the proverbial expert or the practitioner who's coming in. Typically how the world has worked is we've had practitioners come in, experts or consultants who have been given more weightage in terms of the knowledge they hold, and their knowledge is what is used to create a solution, which often may or may not be context aware, which may or may not be just, and might leave out some populations or nature and lead to unintended consequences like maladaptation for those who are actually living there. So it's like a And a lot of this has already been written about, a lot of helicopter research and helicopter practice, a lot of top-down consulting from the global north to the south, and also a lot of money leaking out in the same way, where money is spent a lot more on consultants than on the actual project itself. So these are some of the ways in which things have not worked out. And if we shift these, and if communities are given the role of making the decision, but not just as decision makers without information, but the experts providing them the information need to play the role of the facilitators or the allies in that process. So going back to that point about how do we deal with justice, we definitely have facilitation and allyship in that process, and create spaces for enablers, experts as enablers or facilitators to come in and create consensus, create radical collaboration, ensure that there is conversation happening on difficult topics, ask what is not being spoken about, listen to what's being spoken about, and make the change, act as listeners rather than knowers in that process. So, and what should we do when there is no agreement or consensus? We work on building more consensus and agreement, I guess. The time is such that I don't think we should take action without consensus, and there's always that urgency for action even within the group. So there will always be consensus built on certain actions, which might be beneficial to everybody. So that's definitely something that should be prioritized, consensus building.
Thank you very much. Now, I would like to take a little step back and look a little bit deeper into the topic that's being addressed today. When addressing the word justice, we often associate it with accountability, where accountability means being held responsible for your actions, and justice leans more to being responsible for your community or the greater society. During COP21, also known as the Paris Agreement, the Global Stocktake was established. The Global Stocktake's primary objectives are to assess individual countries' efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emission and to transition to more renewable energy sources. The UNFCCC, also known as United Framework Convention on Climate Change, stated that the Global Stocktake is about ambition, accountability, and acceleration. So I wanted to ask you, what do you make of this? Do you believe that the introduction of the Global Stocktake will be successful in holding countries accountable, resulting in a higher degree of justice? And also, we know that these big international processes are led by nation states, and they often ignore the roles of cities within their implementation. So what do you think that the introduction of the Global Stocktake means in terms of cities and urban resilience?
The Global Stocktake, as much as it sounds like an exhausting exercise, is an important and critical exercise. We can't manage what we don't measure or what we don't take account of, and the Global Stocktake appears to do just that. Not just the greenhouse gas emissions, but also efforts in adaptation and resilience. And the recent synthesis report has talked about the need for systems transformation, the need for radical collaborations, and a greater focus has been placed on the fact that adaptation is nonlinear. Building resilience requires iterations, and then there needs to be an appreciation of plural ways of arriving at solutions of a specific kind. Having said that, this is not enough, because we're still stuck in old ways. Locally led adaptation is still not operationalized in its truest sense. While we have over 100 different entities and organizations that have signed up, we're still working towards how we can operationalize this complex concept. How do we shift power? And the Global Stocktake also does not necessarily take into account this process of shifting power in very concrete terms. So that's a definite step, next step that we need to take. Now, the Global Stocktake happens every 2 years. So we have contributed to the first Global Stocktake on adaptation, on locally led adaptation and resilience, a holistic idea of what is resilience. And we are waiting with bated breath to hear more on what the topic shall result in. Having said that, the topic itself and the UNFCCC processes are not limited to the nation state. While the nation states have been given priority through the national adaptation plans and the nationally determined contributions, there are parallel movements which are probably lesser known by the high-level champions constituted by UNFCCC itself, which are consolidating non-state voices. And this includes civil society, communities, and cities themselves, right? And so a huge portion of this consolidated voice of non-state actors is around cities and urban resilience. The COP presidency also weighs urban resilience as a very important topic. So there is definite movement towards the importance of cities. However, we need to hold this dichotomy with a little bit of care, because in the Global South, cities aren't given the kind of autonomy that cities in the Global North are given very often. There might be devolution of governance without the devolution of funding for it. There might be lack of funds to elect mayors and therefore dysfunctional governments. And there might be scenarios where the politics of it becomes bigger than the governance system. So all these complexities add to this dichotomy of the importance of nation states versus cities. While I completely concur that cities should be given prominence within these processes, and they are, I also feel we need to be careful and more nuanced about what is it that we need to build within these cities before they can take on that mantle of being autonomous voices within the climate space.
Based on your work in water resiliency, we are curious to hear your perspective on Hurricane Katrina and how the water system in New Orleans failed in several ways. First, the levee system failed, which allowed floodwaters to inundate the city. Second, the power system failed, which meant that the water treatment plants couldn't operate. And third, the city's backup water supply system was inadequate. Today, the city has made several investments in its water system since Katrina. For example, the levee system has been strengthened, and the city has built a new backup water supply system. The city has also invested in making water more affordable for low-income residents. Despite these investments, there are still some New Orleans residents who do not have access to clean and safe water. So, what do you think we can take away from this story? Are there ways to respond to disasters through putting justice at the heart?
Absolutely. There are ways to respond to disasters through putting justice at heart, and justice should be at heart of responding to disasters, right? And not just responses to disasters, but also building systems such that we can navigate change. At the end of the day, resilience is more than just bouncing back after disasters. It's about our capacities to be able to navigate through surprises, through complex webs of interconnected challenges, shocks, disasters, and stresses that are already affecting the system when we have this perfect storm melee of multiple crises, such as the pandemic, conflict, food crisis, biodiversity loss, climate disasters, you know. So, and at the heart of all of this, it is those who are facing unprecedented and disproportionate impact. Who need to be put at the center and put at the heart of the response work to all these challenges. In terms of what I can take away from the New Orleans story, I think I would probably invert that a little bit and flip that question and ask, what are those questions that we can ask? Because justice is really about where is it that that the whispers are being made, or where is it that voices are not being heard, right? And I think it's critical to recognize that there are stresses through the racial justice system within the U.S., which have impacted New Orleans way before Katrina hit, which only got exacerbated with Katrina. So if we're talking about building resilience, it's also a question of racial justice as much as it is about disaster risk resilience in this process. Second thing that I would ask is, where is nature in these conversations? The levee, the water treatment systems, are infrastructural solutions that might help mitigate the risk up to a certain point, but there needs to be space to breathe for the city, for the water to come in, to be absorbed, to create spaces such that the city can use nature as far as possible. I'm not saying nature is the only solution, but there is nature within the GAMU solution available. So that's two, in terms of environmental justice. And number three, who's occupying those unoccupiable spaces? Who's living next to the levees? Who's living in spaces not serviced by the water systems? And those dichotomies of space and that relational spatial justice is another important part that we need to capture and understand. And I've never been to New Orleans. It's just based on what I've read, but I think we need to understand all of these questions better while putting justice at the center of disaster risk resilience.
Now, I would like to continue this theme of water within the urban resilience. And another key example that comes to mind are the adaptation and mitigation approaches implemented by South Africa regarding their water shortage problems. As many of the listeners may know, in recent years, South Africa has been struggling with severe water shortages. According to current projections, Cape Town is rapidly what they call day zero, which is a synonym for the start of level 7 water restrictions, where municipalities will actually shut off the majority of water. The drought started in about 2018, and yet according to the International Federation of the Red Cross, at least 11 million people are still facing shortages due to the drought. So I wanted to ask your opinion, and what do you think of their adaptation and mitigation strategies, and why have they yielded so little success over the past years?
Again, Cape Town is a city that has faced the kind of segregation due to colonial and racial systems that it has. And again, it's a question of what are those unintended consequences, right? Until we serve all, we are not going to be able to consider Cape Town solutions a success, right? And who is this water going to? Who is the biggest water consumer in Cape Town? It's typically the wineries. Who owns those wineries, who lives in the racially segregated areas, the shanty towns of the town, and uses limited water, if any, because there is probably no pipe supply. And those are the questions of access, really. Where is water being accessed, and who is supposed to let go of water and who gets water? But then also, who has more power over the water? It's the wineries that bring in more tourists and therefore have more power over that water than other parts of the city, right? So that's one part of the question in terms of the segregation and access. The other part around drought really is, and especially Cape Town, is really the recognition that it is a semi-arid area. There's water is a system, and there is going to be only as much water as the city has. And if we keep demanding more water, which is what has been happening, we are going to reach a point where, I mean, it's dramatic to say day zero because we've been hearing day zero for about 7 years now, the city has been able to avert it every year with like some rain, no rain, etc. All these questions of shortages and cutdowns and allocation restrictions and so on. But like the city needs to recognize that efficiency will get it to this far. And it really needs to build redundancy and diversity in the way it manages its water, manage groundwater and surface water together as a conjunctive system, manage rural and urban water uses together as a conjunctive system because it's the same water, manage nature in a way that we're respecting the indigenous life forms there, whether it's the flora and the fauna, which will allow for recharge and discharge of groundwater or surface water management and allow for more water available, and finally reduce demand. I mean, there is no other answer to it, right? Reduce demand. If we have only that much water, we need to drastically see how we can reduce demand and probably make some drastic choices. As much as that's difficult, and many people find that extremely difficult, but we keep reaching these questions of days ago for as long as we don't deal with this drastic choice of managing demand.
So, Suchi, we've been exploring the different facets of the word justice when it comes to urban resilience. We've heard about some of the challenges, but also the huge potential presented when putting justice at the heart of interventions and programs. To round this up, we've got a couple of reflection questions. What signals of change are you looking out for when it comes to seeing progress on the issue of just and resilient cities? And perhaps do you have an example from a city that you think is leading the way?
Justice itself was a scary word to me a few years back. And the fact that we can talk about it as easily as we are on this call is in itself a huge signal of change and positive change that we're seeing. It's widely accepted among big and small donors, philanthropies, private sector, you name it, everywhere possible, as a word that's intrinsic to the work, to the development work that we're doing. So from that perspective, I think that's a huge shift and that's a huge signal of change that's important. Another key change is, and this is probably an old one, but social media has played its role as well, because a lot of social media gives that transparency, unfortunately without the accountability, so sometimes it gets messy, but gives the transparency for people to be able to create voices and newer voices and important voices for justice. So that's another important change, and we need to have more of it, not less of it. And I think I'm optimistic, to be honest. I'm optimistic about how we approach processes of building justice and approach processes of allyship and facilitation in ways that we build consensus, not from a place of trauma, not from a place of that place of being power down or power up, but really that place of equals. And that's really what is missing even in the climate conversation, but that's what I'm optimistic about, that we'll be able to bring that in at some point. And we're already talking about it. A lot of people are already talking about it. These spaces for radical collaboration, and hopefully we'll see that happen soon. So examples of cities that are leading the way, I think Delhi seems to have done a great job, despite limited autonomy, has done a great job with urban health systems. They've developed health clinics, they've changed or radically transformed the education system, unfortunately hasn't been able to deal with its pollution, but really should apply that those same aspects around justice on pollution as well. There are other cities that have those pieces of great work. Cities in the state of Kerala, Trivandrum or Thiruvananthapuram, Thrissur, and also Kochi and other cities have done great work with solid waste management. And I can think of other places in South America, so Curitiba, I had already mentioned. Sao Paulo, again, has done great work in housing. So there are cities that are showing what justice can mean. It needs strong will, it needs consensus building, it needs facilitation and allyship in that process. And also advocacy. Advocacy has a strong role to play.
Thank you very much for these final insights. I think it was a perfect way to end our first podcast by the Student Takeovers. I would like to thank, of course, Suchi and my co-host Amanda very much for joining us today. And I hope you had a great time.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com or you can tweet us
with the hashtag URDialogues. Chat to you soon.